Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day.
Here's Who Wins March Madness in the Classroom by Sean Gregory and David Johnson. The men's basketball team from Bucknell University, a private liberal arts college with some 3,600 students in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, has enjoyed a run of success over the past 12 years. On Thursday, the 13th-seeded Bison will make their fifth NCAA tournament appearance since 2005 when they take on West Virginia, a number 4 seed, in the first round. Back in 2005, Bucknell shocked Kansas in a memorable first-round upset. The next year, the Patriot League school earned a number 9 seed and beat Arkansas before losing in the second round. Still, the Bison have never advanced to the Sweet 16 and are unlikely to make a deep run this year either. But they can boast about one title none of the other 68 teams can claim. If the NCAA tournament played out in the classroom rather than on the court, Bucknell would win the national championship. According to annual academic performance rankings compiled by the think tank New America and shared exclusively with Time, the small Pennsylvania college is the 2017 NCAA tournament academic champions. Here's how it works. The base score is a school's most recent basketball graduation success rate, GSR, a figure measured by the NCAA that doesn't penalize schools for having players who transfer or go pro before graduating, as long as those players leave in good academic standing. The higher a team's graduation success rate, the higher they start out in the rankings. Bucknell is one of 12 tournament teams with a 100% graduation success rate. Vermont, Winthrop, Princeton, Butler, Notre Dame, Middle Tennessee, Dayton, Duke, Creighton, Villanova, and Kansas are the others. New America subtracted points from schools that graduate men's basketball players at a much different rate than the overall men's graduation rate at the school. To compare students to athletes, New America relied on federal graduation rates since there is no graduation success rate for the general student body. The federal rate takes a cohort of students from 2006 to 2009 and measures if they graduated within 6 years. Even if a school graduated basketball players at higher rates than the overall male population, the difference was counted as a penalty against schools that have low overall graduation rates. Schools were awarded an added bonus for having high overall rates. One important caveat: Ivy League schools and the military academies do not report federal graduation rates for their sports programs. So Princeton, which faces Notre Dame on the court Thursday, does not qualify for these rankings. Just like in the basketball tournament, a team's performance in the academic competition depends on the luck of the draw. Take Butler. According to New America's model, Butler's men's basketball team turned in the fourth best classroom performance out of all the schools in the tournament. But Butler drew Winthrop, the third-ranked school, in the first round. Butler then gets bounced from the academic tournament early. The Bulldogs surely deserve better, blame the NCAA selection committee. Villanova owns the top overall seed in the tournament, and a number 1 seed has never lost to a number 16 seed on the court. That all changes in the academic battle. Number 16, Mount St. Mary's, bounces Nova out of the East region in the first round on account of its solid 79% graduation success rate and a federal graduation rate for basketball players that matches the overall male rate of the school. The lowest-ranked men's basketball team in the academic tournament, according to New America, is UCLA. The Bruins have a 50% graduation success rate and a 20% federal rate. The overall male population at UCLA graduates at a significantly higher rate, 89%, than the basketball team, giving the Bruins a significant penalty. UCLA, led by outstanding freshman guard Lonzo Ball, could go far in the big dance. But the academic victors, like Bucknell, are also worth cheering.
How the Venom spinoff could change the Spider-Man universe, by Eliana Doctorman. A Spider-Man villain named Venom is getting his own movie.
The idea for the spinoff, which premieres October 5, 2018, has been gestating for nearly a decade. But now that Spidey is getting another feature, his most recent reboot, Spider-Man Homecoming, comes out in July, Sony has decided that it's time to give one of his greatest foes his very own feature. Here's everything you need to know about the character and how he could affect the future of the Spideyverse. Venom is technically not a person, but a black goo that latches onto a host and imbues him or her with dark powers. In the comics, the goo first attaches to Spider-Man and controls his actions while he sleeps. Spider-Man eventually scares it away with the help of the Fantastic Four heroes. The symbiote later bonds with Eddie Brock, a reporter who hates Spider-Man, and together they became the villain known as Venom. Venom has all of Spider-Man's powers, except his spidey senses. Over the years, Venom has found different hosts, and sometimes he's more anti-hero than super-villain. Venom has even inhabited Rocket Raccoon from Guardians of the Galaxy. He first appeared on screen in Spider-Man 3. Remember when Tobey Maguire went emo with those awful side-swept bangs in Spider-Man 3? That was because of the black goo. Like in the comics, it attaches first to Spider-Man, then to Turner, and becomes Venom. There were so many villains in that much-maligned movie. Spidey was fighting Sandman, New Goblin, Venom, and, well, himself, that it became a muddled mess, and fans weren't exactly clamoring to revisit the sludge that turned the Spider-Man movies into a bad musical. Sony has been trying to make a Venom movie for a long time. Sony first announced plans for a Venom spinoff after Maguire's last outing as Spider-Man and again during the Andrew Garfield era. Both attempts stalled. Now we're getting a third Spider-Man reboot, this time with actor Tom Holland, so it's inevitable that Venom is getting another shot. Scott Rosenberg and Jeff Pinker are writing the new script. The news may affect future Spider-Man's films. Sony keeps rebooting Spider-Man to keep the rights to the character, so Holland is the third actor to play Spidey in a little over a decade. However, Sony hopes this summer's Spider-Man movie will be more successful than the lower-grossing Andrew Garfield ones, because this time the studio is joining forces with Disney and Marvel to fold Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Holland appeared in last year's Captain America: Civil War, fighting alongside Iron Man, Black Widow, and other Avengers, and Robert Downey Jr. will be showing up as Iron Man in Holland's standalone flick. Sony said last year its Venom plans are totally separate from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's unclear whether the Venom film will exist in a separate parallel universe from the Marvel films, or whether it will have to deal with the events of Spider-Man Homecoming or the Infinity Wars saga that will involve all the Marvel heroes, including Spidey. At this point, we don't even know if Holland will show up in the Venom movie. So, are we looking at a cinematic Spider-Verse? Probably yes, for better or for worse. Sony has long nurtured ambitions to create a larger superhero universe, a la Avengers for Disney, the X-Men for Fox, and the Justice League for Warner Brothers. That means more Spider-Man characters or versions of Spider-Man swinging onto the screen, including Spider-Gwen and Miles Morales. Three people are nearly blind after getting a stem cell treatment. By Alice Park. When doctors give their patients a difficult diagnosis, whether it's for a condition like cancer or a rarer disease for which there is no standard treatment, they often refer them to clinicaltrials.gov. The National Institutes of Health and National Library of Medicine provide this website as a service for people who want to find and participate in trials of experimental treatments. With so many new studies launched every day of promising therapies, it is a helpful resource for both doctors and patients eager to do everything they can to beat their disease. But a report published in the New England Journal of Medicine highlights the dangers of some experimental trials, even ones listed on a government-supported site. three women in their 70s and 80s who enrolled in a stem cell trial to treat age-related macular degeneration caused by deterioration of the most sensitive part of the retina were left with severe vision loss following the treatment they received in the trial. All three patients found the study, sponsored by BioHeart Incorporated, on clinicaltrials.gov. The women each had liposuction to remove fat tissue, and the fat cells were processed to extract stem cells that they were told would develop into cells that would replace the diseased ones in their eyes. Instead, the injected solution caused inflammation, infection, and detached retinas in all three women. Detached retinas require surgery to repair in order to prevent blindness. Within days of receiving the treatment, all three patients went to the hospital with vision loss, severe infections, and bleeding. BioHeart, now known as U.S. Stem Cell, issued the following statement on the results. We are unable to comment further on specific cases due to patient confidentiality or legal confidentiality obligations. Neither U.S. Stem Cell nor U.S. Stem Cell Clinic currently treats eye patients. The study was conducted in several unusual ways, says Dr. Thomas Albini from the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, who was not involved in the trial, but treated two of the women after they developed complications. First, all three women had both eyes treated at the same time, which Albini says isn't typical for an untested therapy. When testing something experimental for the eye, doctors usually treat only one eye at a time in case adverse events occur or the treatment proves too dangerous or toxic to the patient. He says that the patients only signed what appears to be a one-page surgical consent form for the procedure. The form may have indicated that the procedure they would receive was experimental and had not been approved, but clinical trial consent forms are usually lengthy documents that detail the procedure and the risks and potential benefits involved. Two of the women told Albini they did not recall signing documents other than the single-page form. The patients also learned that the trial was being funded by payments they and others made. Each patient who enrolled paid $5,000 to receive the experimental treatment in both eyes, according to the women. The vast majority of legitimate clinical trials do not require payment. In fact, most tests and therapies, even transportation to the facility in some cases, are generally covered by the study. The unfortunate outcome is a reminder of the burden put on patients to vet trials, even if they appear on clinicaltrials.gov. That may be challenging for people without any medical background, especially since clinicaltrials.gov is maintained by what most believe to be reliable and ethical government health institutes. But the site doesn't vet every trial posted. It performs minimal review of study designs to ensure they're scientifically sound and have received ethical and scientific approval from what are called institutional review boards, IRBs. These boards include both scientific experts as well as ethicists to analyze a study to make sure participants won't be exploited. Without mandatory requirements for such board approvals, any investigator can technically post a trial on the site. And while the Food and Drug Administration approves drugs and medical treatments, it doesn't have direct oversight over clinicaltrials.gov. Patients confuse FDA approval of a treatment, which does indicate that a treatment has met certain standards, like its demonstrated efficacy and safety, with just being listed on the website, says Albini. The site does state that clinicaltrials.gov does not independently verify the scientific validity or relevance of the submitted information beyond a limited quality control review for apparent errors, deficiencies, or inconsistencies. But, Albini says, the website could probably do a better job making that disclaimer more prominent. Albini says the incident should reinforce to doctors that simply sending their patients to clinicaltrials.gov isn't enough. Patients need help from the medical community or public health officials to navigate sites like these and make sense of the information they find, he says. President Trump wants sheriffs to help with deportations. Here's what sheriffs think, by Maya Roden. David Clark, the mustachioed and cowboy-hatted sheriff of Milwaukee County, made a request to the Department of Homeland Security earlier this month. In a March 9th letter to Acting Director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement Thomas Homan, Clark said he was deeply concerned about the potential threats that he said undocumented immigrants posed to citizens under his jurisdiction. He asked ICE to empower his officers to round up undocumented immigrants in his community. Clark, a cheerleader for President Donald Trump's hard-lined immigration policies, wanted Milwaukee County to join an ICE program called 287G. Named after a provision in a 1996 immigration law, the voluntary program lets the feds deputize state and local officers to perform some of the duties of federal immigration agents. Clark wanted to participate in a version of the program that screens for undocumented immigrants in local jails and allows trained officers to patrol the streets and identify undocumented immigrants in the community for removal. The controversial sheriff is one of several to make such a request in the early weeks of the Trump administration. Officials in Anne Arundel County, Maryland, have applied to join the program. Bill Wayborn, the sheriff of Tarrant County, Texas, wants deputies in his jail to be able to identify undocumented immigrants. Sheriff P.J. Tanner of Beaufort County, South Carolina, applied to revive the task force model of 287G, which would allow certain officers in his jurisdiction to arrest and detain the worst of the worst among undocumented immigrants, including gang members, drug dealers, and other violent criminals. Those requests are pending, and formalizing the agreements will take time. But Trump's support for 287G alarms immigration reform advocates. I thought that we were close to closing the chapter of the ugly history of the 287G program, says Chris Newman, the legal director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. Since the first 287G agreements were signed in 2002, the program has been a source of controversy. The Obama administration reduced its use, instead focusing on a mandatory program that identified criminal undocumented immigrants in police custody. The number of places participating in 287G dwindled during Obama's presidency, from 72 in 2011 to 37 in 16 states as of this month. That could change under Trump. The president asked DHS to enter into some 287G partnerships in his January executive order on immigration. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly called the program a highly successful force multiplier in memos outlining the order's guidelines. Empowering state and local law enforcement to assist in the enforcement of federal immigration law is critical to an effective enforcement strategy, Kelly said. Between 2006 and 2015, more than 402,000 immigrants were identified for removal as a result of the program. Trump has ordered DHS to hire 15,000 new agents and take an aim at so-called sanctuary cities, places where local officials choose either to limit engagements with ICE or not actively enforce civil immigration law by threatening to block some federal funding. But hiring officers takes time, and getting the money to pay them takes an act of Congress. To fulfill his pledges, the president could use the help of local and state officials. Through 287G, ICE can tap into local resources to carry out its mission. The program has a fraught history. Initially, its focus was supposed to be narrow. Officers apprehended only dangerous criminals, and its application was limited to jails. But that changed in 2006 when Jim Pendergraf, a sheriff in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, allowed his officers to screen for violations of civil immigration law. Pendergraf, whose goal was to get as many undocumented immigrants out of the area as possible, went on to become the chief of ICE's Office of State and Local Coordination, and his model informed the department's approach as the program's use grew, especially in the South. Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio ran the most notorious program, using it to justify massive sweeps during which Latinos were racially profiled and suffered civil rights abuses. In Arpaio's Maricopa County, there were people in yellow suits running around catching Hispanics, recalls Musafar Chisti of the Migration Policy Institute, which published an in-depth study on the programs in 2011. There was a lot of bad imagery, he says. Given this history, some law enforcement leaders have come forward to say they won't participate in the program, no matter Trump's wishes. Local law enforcement is pushing back because 287G doesn't serve their interests in terms of public safety, says Ali Nourani, the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. In late February, the newly elected sheriff of Texas's Harris County, which includes Houston, announced he would no longer participate in the program. The Los Angeles chief of police said in November he planned to maintain separation between his department's activities and those of immigration enforcement officials. After a recent raid in Santa Cruz, California, the city's police chief denounced the feds' tactics. "We're not here to enforce federal civil immigration laws. We don't enforce federal civil debt collection laws. We're a criminal law agency," says Lawrence Byrne of the New York City Police Department. "Our mission is to prevent crime, investigate crime, and prevent acts of terrorism." On March 1st, the 63 police chiefs and sheriffs who make up the Law Enforcement Immigration Task Force signed on to a letter that said they don't want their officers acting as immigration enforcement agents. Mike Tupper, the chief of police in Marshalltown, Iowa, was one of the signatories. He says programs like 287G make it hard for immigrant communities to trust local officers. "If immigrants cannot differentiate between the local police and immigration enforcement officers," Tupper says, "they won't know who to trust if they witness or are the victim of a crime." "The nuts and bolts of policing is daily interaction with the community that you're serving," the chief told Time. "It's very difficult to do that when you're engaged in federal immigration enforcement." This view has been criticized by Trump and fellow immigration hardliners. The Federation for American Immigration Reform says that local authorities that shun enforcement responsibilities are being unfair to legal immigrants and create an environment where terrorists and other criminal aliens can go unnoticed and uninterrupted. Like other opponents of the 287G program, Harris County, Texas Sheriff Ed Gonzalez says it is not that he doesn't want to work with ICE or even that he will not. He told Time he backed out of the 287G program earlier this year, not only because of the controversy it generated, but also because of his department's limited resources. The county spent $675,000 staffing the program, money Gonzalez says could be used to buy new patrol cars or bolster his investigative unit. "I felt that it would also be appropriate," Gonzalez says, "to separate ourselves from that program and to focus instead on community policing." The 287G program is more popular among sheriffs than police chiefs. Newman of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network says that may be because police chiefs are more pragmatic, while elected sheriffs, like Clark, a celebrity among the far-right grassroots, can be driven by politics. Of the 37 existing 287G agreements, only two are with metropolitan police departments, one in Las Vegas and one in Carrollton, Texas. In the city of Milwaukee, the seat of Clark's County, Police Chief Edward Flynn has said he does not intend to have officers act in an immigration enforcement capacity. Pro-immigration advocates like Newman say they hope that what he calls racist policies, like the 287G program, are not on the rise again under Trump. "I think in the future," he says, "we will look on this period with embarrassment." A quarter of American beer drinkers say they're switching to pot, by Jennifer Kalfas. As legalization of marijuana grows throughout the United States, so does its popularity with beer drinkers. About 1 in 4 Americans are now spending their money on marijuana instead of beer, new research from Cannabis Consumer Group found. 27% of beer consumers are legally purchasing cannabis instead of beer, or suggested they would purchase it instead if it was legalized in their state. The research group surveyed 40,000 Americans last year. About 24.6 million Americans legally purchased pot in the U.S. last year, and that number is expected to grow, according to the study. Numerous states have legalized marijuana for medical purposes, and a smaller number of states have legalized it for recreational use. The Department of Justice under the Obama administration relaxed federal enforcement of marijuana laws in states where it's legal, but the Trump administration may reverse that trend. Still, the group predicts the cannabis industry will grow to $50 billion. The U.S. beer market sells over $100 billion in beer each year, according to the National Beer Wholesalers Association. If marijuana were legalized nationally, the beer industry would lose more than $2 billion in retail sales, the Cannabis Consumer Group says. The group anticipates the cannabis industry will take just over 7% of the beer industry's market. Other studies have supported this concept. As Money reported in 2016, the legalization of marijuana in Colorado, Oregon, and Washington State contributed to beer sales falling in those states, according to research firm Cowan & Company. Most recently, Massachusetts, Maine, California, and Nevada passed measures to legalize the recreational use of marijuana late last year. More than half of U.S. states permit the medical use of marijuana. Donald Trump's best legal strategy? An apology. By Samuel Breitbart and Vinay Nayak. Breitbart and Nayak are students at Yale Law School. It's time for Donald Trump to do something he's pretty much never done before, say he's sorry. In light of President Trump's second major legal defeat in as many months, he may be left with no choice. Without an apology, President Trump's revised travel ban, which was put on hold by two federal district courts on Wednesday, seems doomed to the same legal fate as his first one. Why an apology? The issue has to do with the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, which prevents government officials from intentionally disfavoring any religion. If courts determine that an objective observer would see a law's primary purpose as an effort to single out one religious group, they will deem it a likely violation of the Establishment Clause. A Virginia judge found that the first travel ban had an impermissible religious purpose, citing many of Trump's own statements from his initial call for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States to his later statements about giving priority to Christian refugees. His surrogates corroborated that targeting Muslims was the underlying purpose of the law, with Rudy Giuliani going so far as to say that the president ordered him to transform the Muslim ban into a secular form. But since the Trump administration rolled out a new executive order with different terms and provisions, shouldn't judges let it stand? Not if they think the president's purpose is fundamentally the same. In the past, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it very difficult for laws passed with an impermissible religious purpose to be reissued legally. For example, in McCreary County v. ACLU, the court invalidated a city's public displays of the Ten Commandments, even though city officials added secular documents to the display when a lawsuit was filed against them. In that case, the court determined that the law was changed as a litigating position and warned that an implausible claim that governmental purpose has changed should not carry the day in a court of law any more than in a head with common sense. In yesterday's decisions, the courts saw President Trump's order as a similarly transparent attempt to respond to an adverse legal ruling. In fact, Trump's own surrogates, whose impressive citation counts continue to rise, have said as much. For example, Stephen Miller stated on Fox News that the law only contained minor technical changes and promised that it would yield the same basic policy outcome. Moreover, the Trump administration's national security rationale for the order has been undercut by a leaked Department of Homeland Security DHS memo stating that country of citizenship is an unreliable indicator of terrorist behavior in the United States. Unless a higher court disagrees that the first ban was intended to disfavor Muslims, Trump has a narrow path to proving that the second ban had a different intention. One way for Trump to demonstrate his purpose has shifted is to show that he had a true change of heart. He would have to somehow convince a court that even if the first travel ban appeared to be motivated by a desire to broadly target a single religious group, the second one was primarily motivated by genuine national security concerns. This could prove difficult to do without some kind of apology for his previous statements, including those advocating a blanket ban on Muslim immigration and declaring his belief that Islam hates us. If Trump did acknowledge that consultation with national security experts helped him realize that his misguided call for a ban on all Muslims from entering the United States was a mistake based on his own religious prejudice, the order's stated purpose of pausing immigration from regions with hard-to-vet nationals might have more credibility. Don't hold your breath. As the president once said, "I fully think apologizing's a great thing, but you have to be wrong." Instead of issuing an apology, the president responded to the ruling by referencing the second ban as a watered-down version of its predecessor, and then stating that he still preferred the original order. Though it could be in his legal interest, it's hard to believe that the president will reverse course anytime soon, or that a court would take him seriously if he were to do so. Over a month since his grand declaration, President Trump's own words have proven to be prophetic after all. See you in court. The only problem? The president may not like what he sees. Why an early spring is very bad news for your health. By Amanda McMillan. Unless you've been living under a climate-controlled rock, you've likely noticed the recently unseasonably warm weather. New data from the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS, shows that spring is indeed coming early this year, up to 3 weeks ahead of schedule in some regions, which can have an impact on your health, too. The shift to spring has already happened in the southern Great Plains and the southeast Atlantic coast, according to the maps from the USA National Phenology Network, part of the USGS. In Washington, D.C., spring debuted earlier this month, 22 days earlier than the long-term average from 1981 to 2010. Spring is also making early appearances in coastal California, southern Nevada and Illinois, southeastern Colorado, central Kansas, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, and Virginia, according to the research, and it will soon hit Philadelphia and Indianapolis. For people who hate being cooped up indoors all winter, this may seem like a good thing, but experts warn that changing weather patterns pose significant challenges for planning and managing temperature-related issues that affect economy, society, and even public health. For the third year in a row, 2016 was the hottest year ever recorded around the world. Doctors know that earlier springs lead to longer and more severe allergy seasons. Plants like ragweed have no problem coming out earlier and producing pollen over multiple cycles now, says Dr. Aaron Bernstein, associate director of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health Center for Health and the Global Environment. Hay fever season is getting longer, and those plants are also putting out more pollen because there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Health experts also worry about the effect temperature fluctuations might have on insects that spread infectious diseases like malaria, Zika, dengue, Lyme, and Eastern equine encephalitis. There's no question that when it's too cold, ticks and mosquitoes cannot thrive, says Bernstein. An overall warming trend opens up the chance for them to live in new places and to stay alive for longer periods of time. Experts are most concerned about the diseases for which no vaccine or treatment is currently available. We don't want to have to resort to spraying potentially harmful pesticides over large swaths of land to kill mosquitoes, or quarantining people who enter the country from certain parts of the world, or exposing our children to vaccines that haven't been tested thoroughly, Bernstein says. Other health worries include the higher risk of flooding and waterborne disease outbreaks in rivers and dams that may be overwhelmed by earlier than normal snowmelt combined with increased rainfall. Livestock, food crops, and pollinating insects, like the already at-risk honeybee, can also be impacted by seasonal abnormalities, affecting the safety and availability of the U.S. food supply. Scientists say this year's early spring is likely a combination of climate change and other short-term weather patterns. It's true that we can't really prove that these specific changes this specific year are caused by climate change, says Bernstein, but really that's akin to telling someone who smoked for 30 years that we can't really prove that cigarette smoking caused his lung cancer. Mild temperatures can indeed have downstream health benefits, says Bernstein. They encourage people to get outdoors and be more active. But that has to be weighed against what this is ultimately a sign of, he says. There are plenty of parables in humanity about false temptations that look really good on the surface, but are really signs of something awful.
Nintendo plans to double Switch production after strong sales, by Lisa Edisisco. Nintendo is planning to double production of its Switch console, which launched on March 3rd due to high demand, the Wall Street Journal reports. Although Nintendo had initially intended to manufacture 8 million Switch consoles, the company is said to produce 16 million during the fiscal year starting in April 2017. That means Nintendo is hoping to sell more than 10 million Switches in a 12-month period, according to the journal. Nintendo of America President Reggie Fils-Aimé recently told Time that within 5 days of availability, the Switch had cemented itself as the fastest-selling system the company has ever had in the United States, a much-needed success following the Wii U. Nintendo's previous generation console, launched in 2012, is said to have been the company's slowest-selling console ever. Nintendo CEO Tatsumi Kimishima has previously said the company will ship 2 million units globally this month, but the journal says that number will likely be closer to 2.5 million. The success comes even though the Switch's roster of games available at launch is notably slimmer than the selection that was available for the Wii U upon its release. In response to Time's request for comment, Nintendo said it doesn't have any updates to share regarding production plans for the Switch. The Switch, which was sold out at many retailers as far back as January, also comes off the success of Nintendo's NES Classic. Despite supply shortages, the company sold 1.5 million units of its revamped retro console as of February 2017.
Donna Brazile, Russian DNC narrative played out exactly as they hoped, by Donna Brazile. For weeks now, we've seen a steady stream, not just leaks, of information about possible contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians. This is after the FBI and our intelligence community determined that Russia interfered in the United States election with the aim of electing Donald Trump president. For the sake of our country and our democracy, this level of interference calls for a thorough and independent investigation, and that investigation needs to start now. These malicious attacks were not a momentary cyber intrusion. The attacks were coordinated by a foreign adversary and executed for over a year with devastating results for those of us who were targeted and ultimately for every American. The recent spate of revelations shows communications between Trump officials and Russian operatives, conversations between Kremlin officials about their contacts with Trump associates, and information from our allies about meetings between the Trump team and Russian operatives in Europe. We now know that Attorney General Jeff Sessions met with the Russian ambassador at least twice last year, despite his sworn testimony before Congress that he had no contact with Russian officials during the campaign. But it is not just Mr. Sessions and Michael Flynn, who has resigned over his conversations with the Russians, who have misled officials and the public about the campaign's contact with Moscow. The Trump campaign and Trump White House, up to and including Mr. Trump himself, have repeatedly claimed there was no contact between the Trump team and Russia during the campaign, which we now know is not true. Despite all the deeply troubling evidence, the White House continues to insist that there's no there there. In light of all of this, you would think Republican leaders in Congress would put their country before politics and call for an impartial investigation. Yet even now, the number of congressional Republicans who have come forward to demand a proper, independent investigation by a special prosecutor is embarrassingly small. As a former presidential campaign manager, I know that the very essence of a campaign is its strategy, the ability to design a winning plan. A winning plan requires research, resources, and personnel. Russia's attacks on the Democratic National Committee during the 2016 election cycle compromised each of these elements. When I was asked last July to step in temporarily as DNC chair, I knew things were amiss. The DNC had been hacked, and thousands of staff emails and documents were plastered on various websites. Staff were harassed, morale suffered, and we lost weeks of planning. Donors were harassed, and fundraising fell off. Then, in October, a subsequent release of emails revealed that among the many things I did in my role as a Democratic operative and DNC vice chair prior to assuming the interim DNC chair position was to share potential town hall topics with the Clinton campaign. I had been working behind the scenes to add more town hall events and debates to the primary calendar, and I helped ensure those events included diverse moderators and addressed topics vital to minority communities. My job was to make all our Democratic candidates look good, and I worked closely with both campaigns to make that happen. But sending those emails was a mistake I will forever regret. By stealing all the DNC's emails and then selectively releasing those few, the Russians made it look like I was in the tank for Secretary Clinton. Despite the strong public support I received from top Sanders campaign aides in the wake of those leaks, the media narrative played out just as the Russians had hoped, leaving Sanders supporters understandably angry and sowing division in our ranks. In reality, not only was I not playing favorites, the more competitive and heated the primary got, the harder DNC staff worked to be scrupulously fair and beyond reproach. In all the months the Russians monitored the DNC's email, they found just a handful of inappropriate emails with no sign of anyone taking action to disadvantage the Sanders campaign. But the damage was done. Politics has never been considered a clean sport, but 2016 marked a new low. The DNC, a political party committee dedicated in part to defending free and fair elections, was attacked by the Russians while the Republican nominee for president openly encouraged it. This was not a Hollywood movie about rogue spies and super agents. This was real life. Despite the widely accepted conclusion that Russia launched an unprecedented attack on our democracy, our new president and many in the Republican Party are brushing this off. President Trump claims the RNC's cyber defenses thwarted the Russians' best efforts to penetrate them, and the DNC has only itself to blame for inadequate security. But this wasn't a 400-pound hacker in a basement, as Mr. Trump suggested. This was a foreign military cyber command that also penetrated the White House and the Joint Chiefs. If they did not break in somewhere, it's not because they couldn't. It's because they didn't want to. Let me be clear. This is not just the price of politics. This is not normal. We cannot let this stand. Our democratic process itself was attacked and harmed, and all Americans should be concerned. Senator Chuck Schumer has called for an independent investigation of these attacks. He wants the Deputy Attorney General to appoint a special prosecutor. Or, if the Department of Justice refuses, then Congress needs to create a new and improved version of the Independent Counsel Law, giving a three-judge panel the authority to appoint an independent counsel. And while Attorney General Sessions has recused himself from any investigation into contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice still needs to investigate Mr. Sessions' own involvement in this matter. There is still much we don't know about the methods and specific objectives of the Russian government and others involved in these cyber attacks. Americans deserve to know what happened and who knew what and when. Without an independent investigation to uncover the truth, these troubling questions will not go away. We also need a 9/11-style independent commission to make sure our country identifies the steps we need to take to prevent similar attacks in the future. We let this happen once, but we must never let it happen again.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.